Hey, it's Eric G. Around the House is sponsored by Baldwin Hardware. For 75 years, Baldwin Hardware has been known for its first-class quality and craftsmanship in door and cabinetry hardware. As an alumnus of the Baldwin Hardware Design Council, I can say I have seen the details and quality from design to the finished product. If you're looking for a new style and old-world craftsmanship, I can tell you there is only one Baldwin Hardware. Check out what would look great in your home at baldwinhardware.com.
Get you on the radio, yeah, you gotta get on the radio. If the kids can only hear you, they go out of control. You gotta get on the radio. You want the money and the fame and the sold-out shows, and you gotta get on the radio.
Welcome back to Around the House with Eric G. This is where we talk home improvement every single weekend. Thanks for joining us. We got a special guest here in the studio on the phone today, and welcome to Eric LeMay. Welcome to Around the House, man.
Hey, thanks, Eric. We got the dual Erics going here.
Exactly. So I was just on your podcast. Now you're coming on our show. We're going to have some fun here. You know, you are a multi-talented, multi-faceted person, which is completely fascinating to me because... Well, your grandfather has, in my account and probably in many accounts, had the world's greatest car collection. And so you got to really work with a museum. And I love that.
Yeah, my grandfather was Harold LeMay. And he started a trash collecting company in the Spanaway Parkland area of Washington State in just after World War II. He was in the Navy in World War II and just after that. Began with a single truck called Spanaway Refuse, and it got successful. Just the whole garbage company kept growing and growing and growing as Western Washington kept growing and growing and growing. And one of the things that became his hobby, his passion, his fun thing out of that was car collecting. And saving cars and yep. putting cars away and seeing things that maybe weren't being recognized in real time. And by the time he died in 2000, mm-hmm. He was in the Guinness Book of World Records as having the largest private collector car collection in the world. So he was a Guinness Book of Records holder then. And I think the number they used then was like 3,000 cars.
Yeah.
But when they did probate, went through everything, there was more than that if you count the pieces and things and other stuff. And it ranged. The main collection, what is and was great about it, was it ranged everything from your most simple Model T to a Duesenberg. You know, so it went from the $1,000 car to the $1 million car. It had Ford Pintos, and it had, you know, It was a little bit of everything. It was like a giant used car lot of the 20th century.
So two little personal things of mine. I went to the auction when that kind of parts lot got auctioned off.
Yeah, the great 204th Street auction, the Corvair auction.
Yeah. That's not what it was. So when you know, after he passed and you guys were cleaning out stuff, there was a black... Yeah, you probably even remember this car because it was so, and you and I have not talked about this off air, so this is going to be something that's a little new here that I'm dropping on you because you just jarred my memory. I lost out on a car that I was bidding on that was like a early 50s to mid 50s. I think it was a Cadillac hearse that had these wooden carved things in the side of it that was so amazing. And it was out there. I almost got it, but I lost at the end. And I'm happy I didn't because it was going to be a project. But there was, even in the what was considered maybe the parts cars, was some amazing cars out in that area as well.
No, there were, you know what's really amazing from that auction? That happened in 2002, I think.
Yeah, that's right.
And I actually kind of remember that hearse because I think that hearse has come back to visit at our annual car show.
Because nice.
This is the funniest thing is that cars from that auction, that a lot of people looked at it and said it was a junkyard that we were auctioning off. What they didn't realize was they were a lot of complete rare cars.
Absolutely.
That just needed 15 or 20 years of somebody making a project out of them. And those cars have slowly started to come back to our annual show, where you'll read the signage, you'll say, you know, bought from Harold LeMay in 2002 at a junk auction. And it's like, we all know what that auction was. And here the guy's got this perfectly, you know, the fact there's a line of, there's like five Corvairs that come back now. I think we auctioned off like 30 Corvairs
or
something ridiculous. But there was some good stuff that went that day. That's why I kind of remember that Cadillac, because it did have that wood paneling on it.
Yeah, it was all carved and kind of gothic almost, you know.
Yeah, gothic. Yeah. I think that's what it is now, is like a gothic mobile.
Yeah, it's cool. But so here's where I want to talk about, because it was amazing. And this is a debate that I've sometimes had, and people are probably wondering, and even you are wondering, how is this all related to home improvement? But, you know, there's an art to collecting. And what I say is here's the difference between collecting 3,000 cars and having somebody that's got 20 that is a hoarder. To me, the difference between collecting and the difference between hoarding is sometimes only organization. Because if you've got it organized and placed well, you see what I mean? It's an interesting concept of mine.
That's actually one of the things I get asked to speak about is I put it into three parts. There's hoarders, savers, and collectors.
All right.
And the hoarder is somebody who is indiscriminate about it, that they just have it for the sake of having it, that there's no emotional attachment. I'm making this just very simple to cut down for time, but they make it, they just want it because they feel better just knowing it's theirs and it's not somebody else's. I mean, there's a whole bunch of psychological things that go into the hoarder. We can all see it on the show.
Sure.
Then there's the saver, who sees something beyond any emotional value, but also might have emotional value. I mean, they're not completely.
Yeah.
But they know that it's something that is important enough that if they don't put their finger on it and get it out of circulation or put it someplace, you know, and save it, that nobody else is going to recognize that right now. And so savers tend to be, like in their households, it tends to be people, you know, that save old dishes. That's like one that, like, I have grandparents that always, you know, it was always in my grandma's cupboard at any time, there was a dish from 1948 as well as one from 2008. Like, it was, you know.
But a lot of that was created from the Great Depression and things like that. When people didn't have a lot of things, they learned that they had to save it because it was a necessity kind of thing, versus maybe not so much today.
Yeah, no. And then it moves on to the collector. And the collector sees a time and place for each piece, whether it's in a set or it's in a genre or it's in a story to tell. The collector assembles something and puts it together and figures out where the holes are. Now, Grandpa always described himself as a car saver, but the more we looked at his collection during over the years and you kind of start to analyze it, his collecting eye was incredible, because he didn't just find a 1975 Ford Pinto. He found the exact right Pinto in the right condition to be the one to put in a collection and say you have a Pinto.
Yeah.
Or the right minivan or the right Model T.
The brilliance of that is, and the forethought of that going, okay, if I'm going to have a collection and I'm going to have something that represents a Pinto, which one should it be? And he somehow found that.
And probably just bought it off a used car lot for $400.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's what the other thing people have to realize with his collection, with all of his cars, is a lot of them were just everyday used cars when he bought them.
Mm-hmm.
Like, nobody was buying muscle cars in the late 70s or early 80s.
No, because they were costing you too much in the pocketbook.
That's right. But if you could buy a muscle car and you weren't doing it as a daily driver, and you just found a nice one on the used car lot down the street, you put that up and you find a building, you build a building, start putting those in. And that's what he'd do, is just keep building after building, you build the buildings.
Yep.
And it was real time collecting, and I kind of do it as the, you know, the kid that collects baseball cards that is opening packs and doesn't really think about his baseball card collection for 30 years later when he's looking at the price guides and everything. Well, the smart kids knew not to open the packs in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And wait 30 years and then sell the whole pack.
Yeah, that's the forethought of the collector, really. Of, oh, I you know, it's the kids that have the Hot Wheels cars that are still in the plastic container.
That's exactly it. Yeah. And that's kind of what Grandpa did with his collection. Was he just, as he put cars away, he took very good care of them and his friends, and we have hundreds of volunteers. I mean, there's such a big team over the years that have helped play with these cars.
Yeah.
And that's the other thing for a collector that I think makes it different is collecting is a very social thing. And that's what my grandpa loved so much about the car world, is it was so social and it was so much his friends and pals. And I mean, you could be his pal just meeting him at the Monroe swap meet, mm-hmm. the Portland swap meet, and he'd be ready to talk to you about it. And he just loved the social engagement of the car collecting, the whole car culture world. It's part of what made him really special as a person in the entire hobby, was just bringing people together and having that attitude that it's really about, it's a companionship or a, I don't know what you call it, but
yeah, I mean, I grew up in remarkable. That. I grew up in that world. So my dad was, you know, my grandfather worked on the Model T assembly line. My dad grew up with his dad being a licensed, you know, my grandpa who worked on the Model T assembly line. He worked on in a Ford dealership for years as a mechanic, and then ended up getting out of that. But you know, we grew up with collector cars, and so I mean, I had muscle cars growing up, and we had everything from Model A's to 57 Thunderbirds and stuff like that. And so I spent my childhood on the weekends going to, you know, selling stuff at the car swap meets and that kind of stuff. And it's a complete lifestyle, almost like its own little kind of fun cult in a way, where everybody just helps everybody out. And it's a lot of fun that way. No question.
Yeah. And I think that's, it's part of why the museums ended up working so well, is because I think him and my grandma Nancy, and I think our whole family, has contributed it to sharing stuff. Like, it's not, there's no fun in just owning a bunch of stuff and guarding it and thinking it's like the crown jewels or something. They've been driven. We let friends drive them. We let volunteers drive them. I mean, they get out and mm-hmm. there's always been that it's a shareable thing, whether it's a car show you're hosting or it's going to somebody else's car show or whatever it is. It's a very social sharing aspect of it that was something that was new to me when I started. I didn't know really anything about cars when I started in the museum world, which was funny. That's, I mean, awesome. I kind of had an idea, but I got blown away by that the first year I was the founding director of the Harold E. LeMay Museum. Was I didn't realize how many people had Harold's back.
Yeah.
How many people came out of the blue and said, listen, you're going to need help. Here's my card, or here's my number. Here's who I know. And we got this. And that just, I mean, it still gives me goosebumps in the, I don't think he knew it. I just don't think we were ready for that. How much Pierce County and how much Western Washington was going to kind of embrace it.
Well, and it's amazing because you guys, and there's so many people out that don't know anything what we're talking about here, but you guys, in a fairly quick matter, pulled together a world-class automotive museum and pulled it off fairly quickly with local and national money in a time that probably wasn't the best time to do it.
Yeah, a recession hit in the middle of the end.
Yeah.
But, you know, a huge part of that, like my whole job for 5 years was to go talk to people about why museums matter, why history matters, why keeping the collection together matters, why this needs to be in a public, like why we're giving all this stuff away to a nonprofit organization and why there needs to be, I don't care if you're coming from, you know, one of the school systems or a Rotary or you're a government official, you only get one swipe at keeping a big collection like this of telling the story of art, business, and technology in the 20th century through the automobile. You're not going to get this again. And they blew it with the Harris Collection in Reno.
I know it. I was there for that auction, man. I was at that auction.
And so let's, you know, so that was my, almost my entire job the first 5 years was doing, going to all the morning meetings, the Sunrise Rotaries, the Boy Scout meetings. I mean, anybody that would listen to me or have me, I went to biker club meetings. I went, I mean, just traveled through Western Washington. And, you know, my wife figured out 1 year I did like, in a calendar year, I did like 240 presentations about the collection.
Wow.
And eventually what happens is you kind of get too popular to not take a stab at it. Mm-hmm. I don't know how to describe that better, but there becomes a point where once, kind of like when everybody knows your name and they know what you got and they know what you're talking about, the only way they're going to shut you up is we're going to start acting on it. And that's why it seemed probably to go very quickly, because it was still a 12-year process.
Yeah.
Basically. But to most people, probably like you, it looked like it just went fast. But it was that 7 or 8 years of just, you know, and then where was it going to be became a big thing too, because, you know, as much as you get one shot at keeping the collection together, what was that collection going to be?
Yep.
You know, how big was it? Where does it go? Is it a Seattle project? Is it a Tacoma project? Heck, is it a Centralia project? I mean,
yeah. Where's that go? And thank you to the city of Tacoma to step up on that.
Yeah, they did great. I mean, everything started. It actually, like you say, it went fast. I'm like, oh, those were the longest 10 years of my life.
But from the outsider, it looked fast.
Yeah, it did. It did go relatively fast. And we had great local government and state government and federal government that helped. You know, once everybody was on board that we were going to do this. And that's kind of how we ended up with two museums, because there's a LeMay America's Car Museum in right next to the Tacoma Dome. And then there's the LeMay Collections at Marymount.
Yep.
And Marymount's an old boys school in Spanaway. Yep. Well, it's right on the Spanaway Parkland border. So this is always the argument. I like to call it Spanaway because my address is Spanaway. So I always like to say it's a Spanaway museum. But everybody lives in Parkland, Tacoma, so thinks Parkland's better because that's the PLU side of it.
Exactly.
But, you know, kind of what happened was then it was figuring out which cars go to ACM. Mm-hmm. And go into that collection, and then which cars stay in a family collection that's a new museum and a new nonprofit. And the big thing was that we couldn't ACM is one of the greatest car museums in the world, but that's really where their focus is.
Sure.
The LeMay Collections is the kind of cars, I mean, we still have, I don't know, 600 or 700 cars on the property at Marymount, but it's also got a lot of the everything else.
Yeah.
And it has an art museum, and we've got a Rodin thinker. We've got a whole bunch of Rodins. If you ever want to come see a great sculpture garden, come to Marymount.
Okay.
Because we have one of the original cast thinkers there, and it's cool. Really a well-designed sculpture garden. And, but there's a chapel there that's beautiful. I mean, we've got an outboard motor collection. There's hose nozzle collections. There's truck collections. There's fire truck collections. There's car collections. So those became two different personalities of the museum.
Sure.
And I describe Marymount as being more kind of the dirty fingernails, car guy, collector person, hands-on-ish, not perfect, but pretty fun to look at type museum.
Yeah.
Whereas ACM is just an absolute world-class tourist attraction, and it's so well curated and it's so well done professionally. And they focus on mostly on cars and telling car automobile stories.
Sure. That's awesome. That's awesome. And see, that to me, I mean, you know, and you and I talked about this off air earlier, but one of the times we've talked here, but long story short, my son, his middle name is named after, you know, that Tucker that's in the collection. That exact car was, you know, I was really? In a car show. Yep. That's my son's
is
middle
that
name.
Tucker?
That Tucker. So
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that. Yeah. I was literally looking the thing over and just fell in love with the car. Cause you know, I'd seen the movie and other stuff, but I had really fallen in love with that car and the attempt of coming up with that class of vehicle and put it into production, that car inspired me for his middle name. And it's cool. Yeah. So,
well, there's a funny thing about that Tucker in that my grandma bought that after my grandfather had died. And grandpa had always thought that the Tuckers were kind of overhyped, to be frank, because yeah. They aren't very good cars.
No.
And he couldn't figure out. We went and looked at one in Milton, Washington one time, and I'm riding back in his rollback with him, and he's asking me what I think about it. And I forget that, you know, there's some number that had been thrown around, and it needed to be restored. It wasn't in very good condition. The number got thrown around. And his thing was by the time you're done with it, you're just to make it drivable and make it nice enough to be accepted, you're probably about $300,000 you've spent on the car.
Yeah.
And Grandpa's thing was that there's no way that car's worth that much. Like, you know how many other things I can buy for that type of, I mean, this is the way he thought about though.
Yeah. Like, that's in that, you know, not Duesenberg class, but up in that level of vehicle. And he's like, that's not that kind of vehicle.
It's not that type of vehicle. It wasn't doing it for him. He watched the movie a couple of times, but then the last year he was alive, that Tucker kind of got gobbled up, and he suddenly realized he couldn't find a Tucker, and he had made the wrong. I don't think he would have said that. He made the wrong decision or he had the wrong thinking about it. But what he didn't take into account was there was only so many of them that would ever come up for sale.
Yep.
And so it wasn't about the price of it. It was just that people didn't get rid of them after they bought them.
Yep.
And he always thought that they were going to kind of get bought and sold and the price would come down once people forgot about the movie and everything. Instead, it kept creeping up.
Yeah. And I mean, I saw one on a Car and Driver issue a few years ago that was online that I think it sold for $3 million at auction.
Yeah, so when the Peterson Museum in L.A., they had two of them. They were fortunate enough that they kind of inherited one, and they had Preston Tucker's original, so they kept Preston Tucker's original. And then this is number 7. It's the car that's in at Marymount.
Mm-hmm.
And so me and my Uncle Doug and my grandma and David Madeira, who was had just started as the director of America's Car Museum, the new director,
mm-hmm.
We all went down there and – it basically was a one bid sale and grandma bought it. But here's what was the funny part was we didn't really know. We knew what we knew from the movie. We didn't really know a lot about Tuckers.
Like, sure. Yeah.
You know, like I had a pretty good idea. I knew about the helicopter engine. I've been doing some research, kind of my curatorial side that had been curious, but my idea was I was just going to drive it home on Pacific Coast Highway. No, this is a true story. And we had actually talked about we were going to take it on a tour of the West Coast and drive the Tucker back to Tacoma. So we're going to go El Hit Tacoma in a Tucker. And because it just sounded fun. And it just, you know, it was like, now that you got one, let's enjoy it. And so we all pile into the Tucker. And the Peterson has this big parking garage on the back side. Mm-hmm. And we had to drive it down and get onto Fairfax, I guess, and pull into Wilshire. And we were just going to take it around the block. And we weren't even out of the parking garage. And the thing was overheating and the brakes were failing. this ain't driving home on the Pacific Coast Highway. So and here we are all stuffed in the car. There's like 4 of us in the car. We're so excited and trying to figure out how all the knobs work and how you shift with it and the whole thing. And it was overheating. And so shipped it back to Tacoma, did some very cosmetic things to it.
Yeah.
And it's been a good driver ever since. It just wasn't ready that day to start driving. We were so naive about it.
That's awesome. You know, and yeah, I mean, that's a killer story with that, because that's just, yeah. I mean, they were so far ahead of their time, you know, with the helicopter engine and the padded parts in the interior and the center headlight that moves. I mean,
it had a padded dashboard,
yep.
But then it also had a safety area under the dashboard,
mm-hmm.
that had
you could hide
three quarter inch steel. So instead of having seatbelts, they were originally going to have seatbelts, but
yep.
People in their focus group said that having seatbelts made it sound like it must be inherently unsafe. This is, you know, this is post World War II. Yep. Seatbelts are bad marketing.
Yeah.
So they did this reinforced cowl thing, and so you could slide under on impact, and you'd be in a safety zone and crouch down. So if you ever look inside the car, there's this big giant dome of an area where you're supposed to slide underneath to be protected. The front and rear seats are interchangeable to keep wear from having to be a problem.
That's brilliant.
I mean, there are so many things. The car actually exists, and we love showing it to people and having people get up close to it and to drive it. I mean, I've driven it down Portland Avenue in Tacoma.
I'm super jealous. That's awesome.
It's a quick little car. As long as you keep moving. If you stop at a light, it overheats. I mean, that's just the problem with an air-cooled airplane aluminum engine.
Yeah.
It gets really hot really fast, and it cools down really fast.
Well, that's meant to, you know, but that's awesome. Well, that's down at the other museum at the Marymount.
That's at Marymount.
Yep.
Usually it's at Marymount. Sometimes it gets loaned to ACM. It's kind of one of those call ahead type. If that's really what you're coming for, find out where it is, because we do exchange a lot of cars back and forth between the two museums. Sure. They're two separate organizations, but they do cooperate very well together and kind of stay in sync, as Marymount does and ACM does with museums all around the country.
Yeah.
And so that's the other thing is that once people started catching on that we had this library of automobiles, when they were doing different shows, they could look on the computer and see what we had in our collection and then borrow it. And so, you know, there's a lot of LeMay cars that have gotten loaned out to museums across the country.
Nice. That's awesome. That's awesome. Very fun. Well, and that's to kind of put a round circle on this. I mean, that's the brilliance of a good collection. And really now there's two collections, technically, I guess.
But, yes, there are. Yeah,
I mean, that's really what it is. But, you know, I started out this conversation with you kind of wanting to talk about collections, and this is just the perfect example. And I've done radio shows, you know, on hoarding and things like that, and you explained it so well as far as just kind of the different stages. And I think there's so much brilliance in collecting like this, because you know, there's got to be somebody out there that preserves history and puts it into, because go out and try to find a Pinto right now. Somebody got crushed. And those examples that he picked up are hard to find out there. They just don't exist, or they're out in somebody's field rotting away.
Yeah, Eric, the way I describe it, with why the automobile is so great for telling 20th century American history, is every single model, every single car is a three-dimensional representation of a time and place regarding design, business, technology, or culture.
Yeah.
That's my little mission statement I've had for 25 years with this stuff. They're three-dimensional, and once those go away, they can't be recreated on a computer screen. They can't be, you know, it's never the same when you get rid of the three-dimensional element of seeing what these people created, why they created it, how they created it. And in terms of industrialization of America, there's really no other single specimen of that that does it as well as the automobile.
Well,
maybe architecture, I guess.
Well, architecture, true, but I mean, there's something that says that tells a story of the 20s as a Model J Duesenberg, and you jump up into a, into the 40s and 50s with a 1940 Ford business coupe, and you jump into, you know, the into the 50s with Thunderbirds and Bel Airs. I mean, as you go on the story, there down the story of pop culture, those cars do tell such a big story from your 59 Cadillacs and your 1965 Lincoln Continentals. They all tell stories, you know.
Right, but then you also had the 59 Packard Studebaker.
Yeah.
Which, you know, so here was Packard and Studebaker both going bankrupt.
Yeah.
And they were trying to combine their car parts to create a basically a ogre big giant car. Yeah,
like American Motors did in the 70s.
Right.
Same kind of thing.
And those are business stories. That's like how when we hit recessions, when we hit things, when things got bad, when, you know, and those are always things even now that I think about today and what's going on, that those cars reflected all of that time and place.
Yeah.
And the cars that we have today are going to end up reflecting that time and place too. You may not be able to see it quite right now. But, you know, maybe it has to do with electric. And maybe we decide we don't need to go more than 200 miles. That's like my big thing with electric automobiles is, everybody puts 220-volt charging stations into their new homes.
Yeah.
Maybe they suddenly realize they didn't need to go 250 miles every time on a charge. Yeah. And that was a dumb, like, that was a crazy thing to worry about. How far can it go? Maybe you want to worry about how fast can it go at freeway speeds? What's its acceleration like from 0 to 60 getting on an on-ramp?
Sure. Those are all important things, and you're right. You know, and that's, I think what you're going to see just with where we're at today in the timestamp of we are with all this stuff, and we're definitely not going to make this some virus edition, but I think you're going to start seeing automobile manufacturers going, and now we have our air cabin filter with the LED, you know, using light, you know, UV light to give you sanitized air coming in your car. These are going to be the features you're going to start to see in automobiles, I think, coming up, because now people think that way.
I can completely see that. I mean, I think there is going to be in the next 5 years, I think this was a big enough of a jolt to industrial America that it's going to change what the design and technology of industrialization in the automobile is going to be in some museum in 50 years, and they're going to know the cars that came out of the pandemic.
Yep.
Not just American cars, but European cars. And, you know, even, I mean, you know, it's going to be, you're going to see a lot of changes and all that.
Oh yeah. I mean, it's just people think differently. And I think even just in human nature, we're going to see handshakes being rethought. 5 years from now, I think it's going to be different. I think, you know, I think that some of this stuff isn't going to go away, but at the same point, I think when the flu bug goes around, it might be a little bit differently because people are now getting used to washing their hands a lot more and not touching things. They're thoughtful of how they touch things. And I think some of those things might not go away like they have in the past.
You know what else is going to come back? Because we at ACM, they do this brilliantly. They have a drive-in movie theater series that they do.
Oh, and I'm a really drive-in theater popular connoisseur, so yeah.
Yeah. Have you ever been to the one at America's Car Museum?
I have not, actually. I got to go hit that. So that is...
Yeah, but can you just picture that becomes the next thing to come back? Is every farmer that's lost his farm suddenly decides to put drive-in theaters back with digital sound in your car? And I mean, like, if you start thinking about it, there's a full circle possibility here that isn't completely out of whack, because kids today don't even understand how awesome drive-in theaters are because you're in the privacy of your own cocoon.
Yep. Hey, I used to take my kids to the one over in Bremerton all the time. So I used to go up there, and I can't tell you how many times that we would get out there, pop the back hatch of the of my Tahoe that I had, and then we'd lay the blankets out and we'd sit in there and watch movies. So absolutely.
Yeah, you should take look it up on the ACM web. Well, I mean, yeah. When this starts going again, America's Car Museum does a great. It's usually about 7 movies during the summer into the early fall, and it's right there on their show court, and they've got different vendors for food and stuff, and it's kind of, you know, you set up your camp, and it's just like it's a good old drive-in movie.
Dude, that's going to be great. Hey, what's the best way for people to catch your podcast, Eric? Because I want to make sure we get your information out there before we wrap this all up.
Well, if you want to, what's mostly about cars, collecting, culture, that type of stuff is it's LeMazing. If you look it up on iTunes or Spotify or anything, it's LeMayZing. And LeMazing. And then I do a more general conversational one, which, as you mentioned, we just did together. And that's called On Level E or Level E and with Eric LeMay. And that's just a broader, it's kind of the one where people can just kind of get, it's very conversational and it runs the gamut of what's on there. And then I do have, and each show has its own place on Facebook also that you can log into.
Nice. Well, Eric, thanks so much for taking the time today, man. This has been so much fun, and we're going to do this again. This was kind of fun diving into this, and we're going to do cars even more. I think that could be a lot of fun, and we could start getting into some of these stories because I love getting into some of these stories with you.
Well, thanks for having me, Eric.
Thanks, brother. Appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to today's podcast. I'm Eric G with Around the House. Now, go down, subscribe, and comment. We'd love to hear what you have to say about today's show. And more importantly, even put a comment in the podcast notes down there or whatever your player is. We'd love to hear what your thoughts are about today's show. And maybe even if you'd want to hear something else in the show, put some comments in. We'd love to hear them. And send us a message over at aroundthehouseonline.com. We'd love to hear your feedback. Thanks again for listening to Around the House. Hey, it's Eric G from Around the House. Are you planning a decking or siding project this year? If you are, you've got to check out my friends at Millboard. Millboard is a completely different kind of composite decking and cladding that enhances outdoor spaces with enduring distinction. Hand molded from the finest oak, it realistically mimics the natural grain and color of premium hardwood. If you're looking for something that doesn't look like plastic and instead real wood, check out Millboard.com. Make sure and check out that interview we did just a few weeks back. That's Millboard.com.